This is merely meant to be a conversation between myself and Darian, but I just thought I would precede that with a very, very brief visual introduction to Dalí and to the subject of the exhibition. Okay, it's sort of supplementing what is there in the exhibition here. The exhibition celebrates the 80th anniversary of the meeting between Dalí and Sigmund Freud, which took place in July 1938. It's also the 50th anniversary of my own meeting with Salvador Dalí. I can't believe it's 50 years, and I've never ceased to be interested in his work and his ideas. So it's been a huge a delight to be able to build around the painting, Metamorphosis of Narcissus, which Tate has lent us, and which you can see here, which is undoubtedly one of Dalí's most magical and extraordinary paintings, which he brought with him to show Freud when he visited Freud in London in 1938, and we'll come back to that in more detail in a moment. But I thought I would, before that, just run through a few things to introduce you more to some of the visual material and some of the ideas, some of Dalí's ideas, before we enter into a more detailed conversation about what we hope to achieve in the exhibition, and indeed what we think about the relationship between surrealism and psychoanalysis, which is a big subject. So this is one of the, let me just say that I'm really delighted with the catalogue that the Freud Museum has produced. And it includes two very fascinating essays, one by David Lomas, who did a previous exhibition on Narcissus at the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh, and one by Ivan Ward, who is the Director of Education. No, that's wrong, but he's the Deputy Director here of the museum, both of which raise some very interesting points. And David's one is about doubles and about the idea of the double. And I thought I would start with this photograph of Salvador Dalí, which is superimposed, the negatives are superimposed on an image of his wife, Gala. And you can see Gala in the background. And it's as though the two are in some way almost merged. And that I will come back to that, because Dalí makes a point about Gala being his double in the poem he writes about the painting. I hope you can see it. Tremendously glamorous picture. So, just a little background. Dalí was really obsessed with Freud. He had read Freud as a student in Madrid. Interestingly, Freud was translated first into Spanish rather than any other European language, or completely. And so Freud had read the Interpretation of Dreams, Dalí had read the Interpretation of Dreams and other things. And in paintings like this one, which is called Lugubrious Game, 1929, it was his reception piece for the surrealists. He sort of presented it and said, can I join the movement? And they said, wow, yes. And it shows all sorts of odd perversions and sexual aberrations and gender changes of a kind extraordinary in 1929, I think. There's a statue, as you can see, with a very large hand, which I think Darian and I might come back to talk about later on. Context of hands and masturbation. Then the self-portrait of Dalí's head at a horizontal angle in the middle, with all these strange things coming out of it as if he is imagining an entire world. And a lot of the little symbols there are directly taken from Freud's Interpretation of Dreams in terms of symbols that can stand a symbolic language for dreaming, particularly with a sexual meaning. Now, this painting was accepted by the Surrealists. The leader of the Surrealists, André Breton, wrote the preface to the first exhibition Dalí held in Paris, saying how wonderful the mental windows have been opened wide for the first time. Now, a kind of rival figure in Paris at the time, Georges Bataille, some of you may know a little bit about Bataille, was equally fascinated by Dalí. He had a rival magazine to the Surrealists called Document, and he wanted to reproduce this painting. And Dali said, no, I belong to the Surrealists, I can't be part of your lot. So instead, Bataille printed a diagram of the painting, demonstrating all the, he says, a psychoanalytical essay on this painting, demonstrating all the ways in which it actually is all about a castration complex. He saw it purely in terms of a sort of Freudian reading, totally unlike the way the Surrealists saw it. But anyway, so this is an important painting from that point of view. Well, this perhaps is taking us a little too far away from things. Dali developed an idea about what he called critical paranoia, which involved the making of double images. He first published an essay on this in 1930 in a Surrealist journal, and he contrasted his idea with the Surrealist notion of automatism. The Surrealists believed that it was through automatism that we might be able to reach the sort of hidden areas of the unconscious mind. And so I'm just showing you here an automatic drawing by André Masson with the wonderful title Vegetable Delirium. Underneath, it's not very clear. But automatism and critical paranoia are rather at opposed ends of Surrealist ideas. Here is the painting. We'll come back to this. We've got the real thing there, which is even better and wonderful. But just the point I wanted to make to begin with is that it is like one of Dali's double images, but with the two elements of the configuration separated out. So you have Narcissus himself, this sort of golden, glowing youth gazing in the water, who then becomes, the same configuration, becomes a terrifying stone hand holding an egg. So the head has become an egg. It's a very, very multi-layered painting, so I won't go on about that now. We'll come back to it. But the idea of the double image, and I will just go on to this, just to demonstrate what Dali meant by paranoia in the double image. He published this little group of illustrations in the Surrealist journal, Le Surréalisme au service de la Révolution, in 1931. And it's called Communication Paranoiac Face. Now, he tells the story as follows, that he was looking for a postcard of a painting by Picasso in his desk. And he found what he thought it was, top left there, but when he turned it on its side, it actually turned out to be a photograph of an African village. Can you see? It's the same thing. Turn it on its side. Read it two different ways. He then showed the postcard to André Breton, who saw it instead as the head of the Marquis de Sade on the right-hand side, with his kind of grey wig as held back there. So that's saying, you know, you can read other things into an image. You can read one thing as something completely different. So so he developed this what he called this notion of paranoia, which was the misreading of the world, you know, a delusion about what you are seeing. And this is one of his first illustrations of it, The Invisible Man. I just like this one because you can see that it's both an architecture and the head of a person. And there are two balls there, which are both architectural balls and eyeballs. And I think there is something in the painting we have here about eyes looking at you, which we might come back to. But you can see that this double image involves architectural features, the shoulder of a nude woman, and then the head of the man. Can you see that there are a whole series of alternative ways of reading it? And that's, Dali became completely fascinated by that idea of the double image, which he called the result of this critical paranoiac activity, which I hope we'll come back to. I'm just very briefly now going to mention one other thing. Go back to this. When Dali came to see Freud, he brought not only with him the painting, Metamorphosis of Narcissus, but a serious article what he regarded as a serious article that he had written called Paranoic Interpretation of Millet's Angelus, painting by Millet, the Angelus, which you can see in the centre here. This is the page of illustrations that Dali included in this essay. And he brought the essay with him. It was published in the Surrealist journal Minotaur in 1933. Same issue that published one of Jacques Lacan's first articles, and the two are related. We can come back to that. And he published this, and he thrust it to poor Freud, who was 82 years old and suffering from deafness. He said, please, will you read this article? And Freud took no notice of anything Dali was saying, just gazed at Dali. And poor Dali got more and more excited and tried to interest him in these serious propositions he had about paranoia and about narcissism and so on. And eventually Freud turned aside to Stefan Zweig, who was the person who mediated this meeting, and said, what a fanatic that boy is. No wonder they have civil war in Spain if they're all like that. Which is unfortunate, because that was not the impression that Dali had intended to give at all in this meeting, which is a shame. So there's a bit of misunderstanding in the meeting. So this is part of the article. And it's very much to do with Freud, this article, and particularly Freud's essay on Leonardo da Vinci. Dali was obsessed with Leonardo da Vinci as well as with Freud, and therefore, of course, the essay on Leonardo da Vinci by Freud was of very particular interest to him. And the essay by Freud, which I'm sure many of you know, is to do with explaining why Leonardo da Vinci, as a homosexual, was unable to finish many of his paintings. But also what Freud published was a diagram. Do you see the bottom right-hand painting there, which is the painting, you probably can't see it, I'm sorry, but it's the painting by Leonardo that's in the, is that the one in the Louvre or the one in London? I can't remember. But the part of the story of this is that Leonardo was supposed to have a childhood memory of a vulture coming and, visiting him in his cot and beating on his lips with its tail. And another psychoanalyst saw in the vulture's shape, we've got a diagram of it in the wall over there, in the Virgin's clothes, the shape of a vulture. So this is a double image that Freud was interested in. Perceived in that painting. And so, of course, Dali is fascinated by that. He then builds up an entire psycho... There you can see it more clearly. Perhaps you can see the vulture head, supposedly, the vulture's head there, and its wing there, and its tail touching the mouth of the baby Jesus, as indeed Freud had described it in the essay. So a double image like this. Then Dali... developed an entire psychoanalytical essay on Millet's perfectly innocent painting of the Angelus, of the two peasants who pause to pray at the sound of the Angelus bell at 6 o'clock in the evening, just to pray on the edge of the land they're ploughing. And Dali then sort of reads it as a terrifying story of sex and death, involving gender switches and involving the substitution of the wife there into a mother. He sees it as a mother devouring their son. And his book, The Tragic Myth of Millet's Angelus, it's an extraordinary story. It wasn't published at the time. It was finished in 1934, but obviously it was far too shocking for it to be published and didn't come out till 1963, when nobody was interested in Dali anymore, so it was forgotten. And so there's one of his paintings based on his interpretation of the Angelus. And the book is very heavily illustrated, and one of his comparisons is with the woman praying there, which he reads in terms of this, little St. Catherine give me a little husband. And then he puts the praying mantis beside it, which of course was famous for devouring its husband. So it's seen as a kind of rather, you know, terrifying story. And Dali is very careful to say, of course, I'm not saying that Millet actually believed any of this. This is just my reading of it. But it is extremely visual. In a way, that's the point I wanted to get round to, which is that Dali is imagining things which in psychoanalysis are extremely verbal. And I thought we might perhaps develop that a little bit, that the word is terribly important in psychoanalysis and in surrealism. For Dali and for the surrealist artists, the visual had to be accessible, the visual, not necessarily mediated through words. This is a painting called The Spectre of Sex Appeal, which I can see as being quite influenced by Freud, showing the child Dali there with a fossilized penis gazing in absolute horror at the figure of what appears to be a female, though it's very odd because the head, which you can just, it looks headless. These rather terrifying kind of lumps of things tied up, all soft and frightening. The head, which you can see, is also part of the rock behind it, has a moustache. So there's a very odd kind of gender, as so often with Dali, going on there. That's just a ending with a game on the end. Okay, so that was sort of an introduction, and I think we'll now talk more about the exhibition itself. And okay, shall we leave the painting on? We can just leave that.
Hey, thank you so much, Dawn. So I know that the exhibition has been, you've been planning it for quite some time. You had the idea many, many years ago. Why bring this painting to the museum?
Well, two things. One is that some years ago I was involved in another exhibition about Narcissus at the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh, which took the story of Narcissus and the way that artists have used it in different ways up to the present day. I mean, it's an exhibition that sort of started with the Greek myth, with the myth of Narcissus, and ended with Californian artists in the 1960s. So I've always been interested in somehow linking it more directly to the Freud Museum. And when I retired as a trustee, I was lucky enough to be invited to do an exhibition here. It seemed to me this was the ideal thing to do, would be to try to borrow the painting from Tate. I didn't really expect it to happen, but they actually agreed, so we then built on it from.
So it's the second time that the painting has been in the house?
Second time. Yeah. Yes, well, yes. It's the second time that the picture has been in the context of Freud's study.
And you've pointed out that one of the particularities of the painting is that Dali had initially intended it to be viewed in conjunction with reading the poem he wrote with it. Do you know, when he met Freud and brought the painting, did he recite the poem?
It's a very good question. I don't think he did. There's no reference in the quite sort of scanty literature that we have about that meeting. There's no reference to that book being shown to Freud. So I don't know. But there's no doubt that he did write the poem. It's in a book in the case back there that he intended people, he ideally wanted people to be able to read and associate with the painting. Yeah.
And is that the only example we have in Dali's work where he insists on the conjunction of the visual and a written text?
I think it's the only one where there's a direct relationship between the two, where he imagines the image and the words really kind of interacting. So he wrote a huge amount.
But isn't that interesting with Narcissus, the choice of that particular motif, where classically, it's about someone losing themselves in their own image, that it's with that exact idea that he adds a text. He brings in something that isn't, let's say, directly visual.
I think that's quite true. And I don't really know. Dali did did write a lot of poems, and he wrote a lot of texts. So it's not as if it's the only time he did do that, but I think it's the only time there's such a direct relationship.
Yeah.
And I agree that that it's strange when it's precisely, you know, an image that's so much about painting, so much about the visual, that he decides to include it.
And can you tell us something about the history of that work with the Surrealists and beyond?
Of the
fate of the painting was, the reception of the painting?
Yes. Well, it was painted in Austria at a ski resort called Zurs, where Dali's wife Gala was skiing. And Dali was painting in his hotel room. Can you imagine? I mean, it's a strange thought. But all Dali's production at the time belonged to his great friend and patron, Edward James. Edward James, who was the owner of West Dean, here, some of you might know that. And they had signed a contract, which was extremely difficult to organise, apparently. But James managed to acquire all Dali's production from the period 1937 to 1938, including that painting. So by the time they brought it to show Freud, it was actually in Edward James's collection. And it remained in Edward James's collection until it was sold to Tate in the, must be late 70s, I think. All Edward James's collection of incredible paintings by Dali was on show at Tate for a long time, and then he decided to sell it. Half went to the Boymans Museum in Holland, and half went to Tate. So that's been there ever since. But, you know, they've generously lent it here. And it's actually rather wonderful having a single painting that you can really focus on. Yeah. For an exhibition.
Mm-hmm. And the sketches, you've also managed to get the Dali Foundation to lend some sketches.
Yes.
What do they add? How do they inflect?
Well, the sketches, I'm sorry I didn't have one here, but I'm rather hoping you have seen or can indeed now see the sketch that we have on the wall there at the back. And there are then two other ones in the case here. And the point is that all these sketches, all these drawings, show the configuration here of the body of Narcissus gazing at himself in the water and the hand on the right in one thing. Some of the drawings emphasize the egg, some emphasize the head, some emphasize the hand, and some the body. But they are double images, and you see it in the sketches either as a hand or as a body. Mm-hmm. You can't see it as both at once. Well, you shouldn't. So the odd thing, and that is what Dali was doing with the other double images I showed you before, the invisible man. Do you remember the man with the head in the architecture? You see it either as one thing or as the other. Mm-hmm. What he's done here is separate them, which is the only time that I can think of that he does that. So they're two different things. And he had the idea that if you gaze, and you can all practice this actually at the end of the talk, if you just gaze for 10 seconds without moving your eyes, and this is quite difficult to do because our eyes are naturally darting about the whole time, if you fix it on the figure of Narcissus, it will dissolve. And so he wanted the act of viewing to, as it were, enact the myth of Narcissus, which of course is that Narcissus, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead, I'm so rather assuming everyone knows the story of Narcissus, but perhaps not, which is Narcissus, who was a very beautiful youth. Everybody fell in love with him, man, woman, girl, boy. He would have nothing to do with any of them. And you can see him on his pedestal there, turning away from the so-called heterosexual group, which is what Dali called the little group of dancing figures in the middle. One day he was hunting, and he went into to drink from a pool, and he was looking in the pool. He fell in love with his reflection. He didn't know it was his own reflection at first, and he tried to reach it. And of course, he couldn't, because the water would ripple when he tried to touch it. Eventually, he fell in, but he realized it was himself. There was nothing he could do about it. He had fallen in love. That was it. And he eventually just faded away. And when his friends came to collect his body, all they found was the flower, the Narcissus. He disappeared. Other stories, I mean, it's a well-known myth in the classical world, and others have him falling in the water and drowning, and some have him being murdered. So the different versions of it, but that's the Ovid story, and that's the one I prefer, if you like, and the one Dahlia certainly read. So looking at Narcissus, ideally your eyes become slightly unfixed, and it merges with the hand. It's a matter of opinion whether it might actually work or not, but that's part of the idea.
Yeah. Can you say something about the other areas of the painting that tend to be separated out? The greyhound, the snow god, the stony hand.
The stony hand, yes. Well, you can all see, I'm sure, you can see the basic configuration of the body of Narcissus, who's looking, and his knee is reflected in the water. You see the reflection in the water, and his head is bowed. You don't see his face. His head is bowed down. And I was talking to Fiona Bradley, who's the director of the Remark, earlier on, and we agree that we think the head is actually a walnut. The reason it's a walnut is that the walnut is the most like the interior of the human brain, if you it's all sort of wrinkled and peculiar. And early on, the alchemists thought of the walnut as a sort of an analogue to the human brain. Anyway, that's rather beside the point, but there is the head with the hair, which and this side of the painting seems to be glowing. It seems to be fiery. And it could be because, I mean, that's passion. Or an alternative might be, and as Dali often talks about this, what he calls memories of interuterine life, i.e. before he was born, and he claims to remember seeing what it was like being in the womb, being surrounded by glutinous, golden things. So sort of passion fires. And the landscape, this sort of rock rising behind it, almost like melting, like Narcissus. And then on the right, the hand holding the egg. Why does he become a hand? And you know, with the egg, one of the things that was, I mean, pure chance. It seems coincidence. When we were looking for, we were actually looking for the flying phallus, which is one of Dali's favourite images, and talks about in the Leonardo essay, we saw this hand holding an egg, which you can see in the case around there, a Roman sculpture of a hand holding an egg, which is actually apparently the, it's the goddess Hygienia, is that right? Or Aesculapius, to do with health. So but there's no evidence that Dali knew it. But the hand holding the egg, which is also frightening. So, I mean, that is sort of death. I mean, you've got death and life and death and love in this painting. Mm-hmm. What is cancelling out the other? I'm not sure. Heterosexual couple, and then, as you say, in the distance, you've got another echo. And, of course, echo was the other character in the story of Narcissus. Mm-hmm. You've got an echo of the head and the egg. In the element that Dali described as the god of snow. And he started his poem, Metamorphosis of Narcissus, with the idea that the god of snow was melting. As indeed, the snow was melting in Zeus, where he was painting, and the Narcissi were coming into bloom. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of, which he talks about in letters, so there was an immediate connection.
Mm-hmm. And the greyhound.
The greyhound, the dog. That was the last thing he painted, we discovered when we did an analysis of the painting. The dog is, as you can see when you look at the painting, the dog is eating a bit of raw meat. And I don't know, Dali was very interested in the notion of cannibalism as a form of the devouring of something, which could be from love or it could be from hate. Mm. And sometimes he has somebody eating who has clearly been diverted by eating from actually eating somebody who is loved. I hope that makes sense. Mm-hmm. For example, he developed the figure of the terrifying, vengeful father. And the vengeful father was both his own father, and it was God, and it was Saturn, and it was William Tell. And sometimes he paints this character, one of those who is eating something, while little Gala, his loved wife, is in a tiny little shell which could easily be crushed by this horrible figure if they hadn't been diverted by eating that. So quite what it is, I don't know, but I think it's the dog. It's also a mangy dog. It's sort of a sign of... What do you think? I mean, you may not have an idea about it, Darren.
I don't have an interpretation of its meaning. And can you tell us something about your own encounter with Dali?
Well, just very briefly, I was a student at the time. I was writing my thesis about surrealism. I was, this is 50 years ago, and I was basically going around Europe trying to talk to any of the surrealists who were still alive. And Dali was. So I went and knocked on the door and said, I might as well tell this story. I said, can I come in, please, and see Mr. Dali? And the maid said, well, hang on a minute, I'll go and ask. And closed the door, went off, came back, said, yes, he will see you now. So I went in, I said, I'm the student, and I went into the studio, and he looked at me and said, oh, I was expecting the model for my painting. Well, never mind, you can stay and talk to me anyway. And so I did, and watched him painting a painting called the Hallucinogenic Toreador, which is a double image of, he saw the figure of Venus in the Toreador's face. But the really important part of this is that he was incredibly friendly and helpful to somebody who was a sort of neophyte student working on surrealism, not really knowing much about it, and he told me a lot about it. He was very, very friendly. So when I got back to, the art world and the art history world and found that everybody hated Dali because they saw him as a showman and and so on, I started defending him. And I've ended up defending him
and
the rest of my life,
show.
Really, creating the show. Yeah.
So, how do you explain that hatred, apart from his kind of showmanship?
Showmanship. Mm. I mean, politics. Dali really, really went the wrong way with politics in some way. Mm. He wasn't interested in politics. That's the trouble. I mean, he was terrified of the Spanish Civil War. I mean, really, absolutely horrified. Got away as soon as he could from Cadaqués, Barcelona, went to the United States, and all the surrealists, obviously, were very involved, and many of them went to fight on the side of the Republic against Franco. Dali just kept his distance. And then, I'm afraid, after the war, he agreed to go back to Spain when people like Picasso refused to go back to Spain. He said, I will never set foot in Spain while Franco is alive. I'm afraid Dali did go back. Now, my reading of this is not that he actually wanted to be friends with Franco at all. He just couldn't live away from Cadaqués, from his beloved house at Port de Gat. He writes somewhere, the only place I feel loved and I feel at home is at Port de Gat. And so I see it as a sort of compromise, if you like, a selfish compromise, admittedly. I mean, there are many things that actually Dali was extremely guilty of. And he says terrible things and cruel things. In some ways, I think, and this is something that Ivan Ward picks up on in his very interesting essays catalogue, that Dali was constantly trying to defend himself against great fears, and his showmanship, in a sense, is that is not his personality. That is diverting us from what is really his personality. But he said, everything is Dali, I am my painting, I am my work, I am my public persona, this is all that matters. And this is a huge sort of red herring in some ways.
And to watch that work on a painting?
That was extraordinary, actually. Well, the painting he was working on, which is now in the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, is a double image. It's one of the biggest double images he ever did. And he kept saying to me, he'd show that there was a pencil case for Venus pencils with the head of a toreador on it. Oh, no, sorry, and he saw the toreador in this that's mm. Nick. I couldn't see it at the time. I had no idea what he was talking about, actually. but he was only half finished the painting. The curious thing is he was painting with an absolutely tiny brush. But this is an enormous 6 foot tall painting. So I do remember that. So he did paint. There was a kind of miniaturism to his technique, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, many people have said that they've been struck by the small scale of this painting, which is often in a kind of massive reproduction in the Dalí books. Here you have this very modest size,
incredibly
detailed, complex work.
Yes. He did paint on many different scales, actually. I mean, this is a fairly sort of standard landscape style painting. The little one called The Spectre of Sex Appeal I showed you is tiny. It's that size. Whereas the hallucinogenic Toreador, which is what he was working on in his studio when I went there, is, as I say, gigantic. So there's a variability.
Can you say something about how he saw psychoanalysis, what his relation to Freud was?
Yes. Well, I'll try. I would make come back to you on that. He wrote something called The Secret Life of Salvador Dali, which is one of the best autobiographies you can possibly read. Half of it's made up and half of it's true, and you never be quite sure which is which, but you know, it doesn't really matter. It's a fantastic read. He writes wonderfully. And there he says that when he was a student, he read Freud, read The Interpretation of Dreams, and was gripped by a mania for self-analysis. So he was trying to analyse himself and his drawings. And then he develops this sort of dream symbol language in some of the paintings. He read Freud. The Surrealists were fascinated by Freud, terribly important for Surrealism, but not so much because of Freud's extraordinary discoveries about infantile sexuality and about sexuality generally. The Surrealists were interested in theories about the unconscious. Dali was fascinated by Freud's arguments about sexuality, about the fact that there's, you know, everybody has a degree of normality and a degree of paranoia, for example. That Dali was really interested in that side of things. And he certainly read the Leonardo essay, he read the Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he read the Three Essays on Sexuality, and there are echoes of all these in his writing and in his painting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very interesting image, not only in terms of what it says about Dali's relation to psychoanalysis, but also for the window that it opens up to the whole question of interpreting images. And there's a very nice essay by James Elkins, the art historian, where he argues that the Angelus essay by Dali, however ridiculous it is, and he pointed out some of its absurdities, is a kind of paradigm for art, you know, art theory in the 20th century, because it takes an image and it imposes a whole lot of theory on an image. It interprets every detail in the very specific sense of trying to find a meaning for the details, in exactly the same way that in the sort of massive literature on paintings like this, every element is ascribed a meaning or different meanings by different commentators. And so one could see the project in the Angelus book as a kind of reductio ad absurdum of that approach of trying to find meaning in an image. And it seems very interesting to, if we go back, you raised the question earlier of the relation of words to images. And again, you know, why does Dali insist that the painting is viewed with the poem? And you have, you made the opposition between Breton and some of his colleagues' emphasis on automatic writing and Dali's emphasis more on the paranoid critical method. And it's interesting to link both of those to the question of how, you know, what happens between words and images. And I think, you know, this is this is very important for surrealism and also in terms of trying to think about the painting, because when Freud, in The Interpretation of Dreams, which Dardy, as you said, had read very, very carefully, talks about this, he has several sections on exactly that question of the relation of words to images, arguing that words are transformed into images at the point where an encryption is necessary, where they need to be disguised. And what's the kind of the main form of disguise? It's the generating of incompatible realities, incompatible, impossible juxtapositions, which is obviously the kind of cliched image of what Dali's work is about. Although there's plenty in Dali that isn't like that. If you sort of read a standard, you know, book about surrealism or about Dali, a kind of popular book, it'll say, you know, what characterizes works by Ernst Dali is exactly this juxtaposition of impossible, of elements that don't go together. And Freud's argument is that this is made necessary when a thought is being disguised, is being encrypted, so it will generate two things, two visual images that can't go together. So in that sense, it's very interesting to go back. You mentioned the this sort of battle for the image between Document and Minotaur. Bataille was obviously very sceptical about all this, and Breton, two different appropriations of Dali's image. And the kind of the usual discourse around it is to say that, you know, Dali's is a kind of art of the liberation of sexuality, which you see in the kind of echoed in, remember, the show at the Tate, which many of you might have seen some years ago, called Desire Unbound. When in a way, I think what Dali shows us is the exact opposite, that it's about desire being bound, not unbound, because it's an art of censorship. It's not an art of sexuality being on display, even if we can see, you know, a masturbator, an ossified penis, a praying mantis, you know, a lot of excrement in the paintings. But what matters is the juxtaposition, the impossible juxtaposition of those elements with something else, things that you can't encounter in reality. So that at one level you might think you're seeing a kind of liberation, sexuality in its pure state, but actually it's an art about censorship, about what can't be represented, which then generates these incompatible images. If we then go back to this, you pointed out that this is something very unusual in Dali's work, the bilateral symmetry of the doubling, that you have the figure and the hand.
Why?
We're not enjoined to start from the figure and move to the hand. We could start with the hand and then move to the book. But why do you think that's so unusual in Dali's work, that odd symmetry of the doubled images?
Well, I mean, one of the things I think about is not, I mean, doesn't really speak to what you're talking about in terms of encryption and disguise, in a way. But one thing I think is that he was possibly thinking about a stereoscopic, so this is to do with an optical effect. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this is to do with optical effects. Mm-hmm. The stereoscopy where you take two almost identical images, photographs mm-hmm. usually, and put them in a special viewer, and they merge and spring to three dimensions. And it's as though he was thinking, you know, he might make it real, if you like.
Yeah.
Which is curious, given how unreal it all is. I mean, I think that might be one of the ideas that he had about this. But I suppose, coming back to the hand, you know, obviously he uses a certain amount of symbols that he takes ready-made from Freud, Interpretation of Dreams. But why the hand here? I mean, this...
there's the famous story. I don't want to interpret what it means, because that, in a sense, we'd just be following the Angelus essay. But I mean, there's the famous story about Dali's hand, isn't there? When he's, I don't know if you're familiar with this, that he was in a toilet and was fascinated by a blob of dried mucus on the wall. And he kept on going back to look at it. There is a question of why do people often put mucus on toilet walls? And eventually he scratched off a bit and then started to develop fears that he'd been infected.
He got lodged under his
nail. Under his nail. And of course, you know, lo and behold, a day or 2 days later, his hand had swollen and he developed some kind of dermatitis. And he was in bed worrying, and he had the image of his hand as being separate from himself. And again, it's a kind of motif, the idea of this kind of autonomy of the hand. But I guess at a more general level, when we look at the painting, one of the things that Dali shows very clearly is how, you know, the so-called natural world, the world made up of lakes and rocks and mountains and so on, is ultimately made up from the body. The body is a kind of starting point for our relation to the world. And I think that, again, if we focus on this painting and the paranoid critical method that Dawn mentioned earlier, you can see that Dali is still relevant today in terms of debate, psychiatric debate about hallucinations, about delusions, because Dali's view is very, very particular that it's not that we see reality, that there's a kind of shared reality that all of us will see, and then we'll imply that there'll be a sort of specific interpretive grids that each of us will apply to this shared perceptual reality. But Dali's idea is rather that the perception, initially, our very first perception of reality, is itself interpretative, is itself an interpretation, and hence the way in which a single image, like the figures in the Angelus that Dawn showed us just now, which are repeated from one painting to the other, different configurations of the visual world just repeat the same motif again and again. So Dali's argument is that in so-called paranoia and, let's say, everyday life, not non-pathologized everyday life, it's exactly the same process. That we're not all seeing something and then interpreting, but what we see is initially an interpretation.
What we see is already is always already an interpretation.
Yeah,
exactly. And that is what, I mean, he's talking about paranoia, not as it were limited to people who suffer from some sort of clinical neurotic condition, but that everyone actually, to some degree, is living with this need for interpretation. And he ends, in fact, the tragic myth of Mrs. Angelus rather interesting, saying, oh, you know, the whole of history is a form of paranoia. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's all in sort of interpretation, which is actually also very similar to what Freud says at the end of the Schreber case, where he says, who can say if there is more delusion in my analysis of Schreber? Or, you know, more truth in Schreber's delusions.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is, so there's a, you know, nothing is actually quite stable. And that, in a way, is the great anxiety, I suppose, in many of Dali's paintings, that there is, you know, that these alternative readings actually prevent any single, as it were, you know, definite reading of it. It will elude you. It's you know, either or, but never actually that. Is that, I mean...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the Freud quote from Schreber, and Dali obviously famously says psychoanalysis is a delusional system, and Lacan later on says the same thing. So it's interesting to have Freud, Lacan, and Dali saying that psychoanalysis is a delusion.
It's a delusion.
But in this specific sense.
No more than everybody's.
Implying, you know, an interpretation that's imposed on, you know, or that's not imposed on a shared reality, but that the process of perception is interpretive in itself.
I mean, the quote that we have written up above the vitrine on the right-hand side there, which is this famous thing that Freud is supposed to have said to Dali, and nobody can find out exactly where it's recorded, other than what Dali says he said it. What I seek in your pictures is not the unconscious, but the conscious. Mm. You have, you know, found a mechanism to reveal the unconscious. Now, Ivan's essay made me think about a little bit more about that, mm-hmm. because it's as though the, as it were, the work of interpretation is mm-hmm. is almost disguising something else. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But so what did Freud mean by saying it was the conscious he looked at and, you know, that he found in his paintings? He'd done, just simply that he had done some work of interpretation himself.
Yeah, I mean, I find that very enigmatic, that sentence, if it's correctly transcribed. You know, what does it mean to look for the conscious in the painting? Does he mean it in the sense of just what is on the surface, or does he mean it in a more precise topographical sense of distinguishing the unconscious, the preconscious, and the conscious? And it goes back to André Breton's unusually perceptive remark that what he's interested in, you snigger at him because most of what Breton says isn't very perceptive. But when Breton says, and it is kind of a perceptive thing to say, that what he thinks, you know, the key to the Freudian, you know, question of desire is not so much the unconscious, but rather how the unconscious desire operates in what he calls preconscious waters, which is a very nice expression. It kind of goes with our lake, in the sense of, you know, what mechanisms of distortion and encryption operate on the unconscious thought once it moves along in its path towards representation. And then you've got a kind of splitting. You know, you can either have the idea that ultimately we can find a declarative form for the unconscious desire where we would be able to represent it directly, put it in propositional form, say what it is, or the idea that maybe unconscious desires can never take a declarative propositional form. You can never say, this is what an unconscious desire is. You know, I want to X, Y, Z. But rather, desire is just equivalent to its own distortion, to how it emerges in disguise, in encryption, in compression, or the mechanisms that maybe Ernst and Dali perhaps took more seriously. But I mean, yeah, that, in a way, that's a kind of separate question.
Yeah. Well, no, but it does raise the question of how the surrealists actually intended to mobilize what they took from Freud. Which is in a totally different direction from the direction that Freud was interested in, which probably everybody here is familiar with. I mean, what the Surrealists did, but they claimed that they had just as much right to, as it were, you know, to investigate this unconscious that Freud had.
Is it the same unconscious? I think it's a very, very different.
Well, I think they take a very basic view that yes. Yeah.
I mean, if we say the surrealists, because, you know, between Éluard, Crevel, Breton, the idea of the unconscious is totally different. You know, they all had very different readings of Freud. When we say, you know, the surrealists' engagement with Freud, I mean, they're very, very different.
Well, some of them actually didn't agree with Freud at all. I mean, quite, you know, people like Aragon really disapproved of Freud and disapproved of the whole sort of analytical apparatus. Yeah. The others, I think, they took it as a sort of invitation to experiment with different kinds of processes, with different kinds of practices, to see whether they could produce something that was not pre-planned, that was not sort of consciously, you know, organized and modulated according to traditional methods of constructing a picture.
Well, one could argue that ultimately that has much more to do with spiritualism than it does with Freud. The idea that...
No, because they never absolutely never accepted the idea that the spirits had, that you were making a connection with something else.
Yeah,
they were simply suspending...
I think Breton did.
No, he didn't.
Breton's got the idea, in the first manifesto, it's all based around the idea of a kind of G-spot contradictions are resolved.
Well, he uses some of the terminology from... Mm-hmm. I mean, he uses terminology of Janet and of the spiritualists. Mm-hmm. I mean, he talks about modest recording devices, mm-hmm. which are like the spiritualists. But that's mm-hmm. simply a way of actually trying to indicate some of the methods they were using, which didn't necessarily mean they they had subscribed to what the spiritualists were.
But the first manifesto, it all revolves around the idea that it's possible to access a point where contradictions can be resolved.
That's true. Yes.
Which is much more of an idea linked to spiritualist discourse than psychoanalysis.
Oh, I'm not. No, I would agree with that. But I think one can't take it any further than that because of myself anyway.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not a kind of wholesale acceptance of the main tenets of a spiritualism, but the idea that we often find in Surrealist writings of the unconscious is like a kind of secondary consciousness, a kind of deeper, buried consciousness.
I think there's certainly the implication that you can get at something, not that it is constantly elusive and actually impossible. Yeah. I mean, I think that's quite true. Mm-hmm. And I think that was taken, I mean, from Freud's arguments about the dream, and the workings of the unconscious mind. Yeah. I mean, that's what they, as I understand it, that's what they took from it. Yes.
Should we open up to questions?
Ruth.
It's fascinating. I'm interested in the portraits that Dali drew. And also, did they talk English? Did they talk German? What language did they talk?
They talk French.
Of course.
Dali didn't speak German. We don't know whether Gala was there too. I mean, there was Zweig's letter the preceding day says that Zweig, Dali's wife Gala, and Edward James are coming, but there's no evidence that Gala actually did go. But she did speak German. I don't think she did go. So they spoke French, possibly with a bit of mixture of English. I mean, Dali tended to speak in a kind of extraordinary mixture of languages.
So it must have been really extraordinary. Freud had been here 2 days after the journey from Paris.
Yeah.
And here was this mad young Spaniard thrusting his ideas and his language and his picture at him. And drawing him. He agreed to be drawn. Were they all done here?
It's become more of a puzzle when we actually unpacked the portraits that we borrowed from the foundation, because the Freud Museum already owns the one that is in the hall there, which is always hanging there, the wonderfully very sort of detailed one with Freud's enormous cranium sticking up. Dali, that there is evidence that he did sketch Freud while he was talking to him. Both Zweig and Edward James say that Dali took out his sketchbook and sketched him. One person says that they didn't like to show Freud these sketches because they revealed death in his face. I don't know. I mean, one doesn't know. But so the question is, which are the drawings that Dali did here? I had thought that it was going to be the kind of very sketchy drawing on the right-hand side there, which really looks as if it's done from life. However, it's on a very large piece of folded cardboard, and it's impossible to imagine Dali using that when he was here. So it's very strange. So it leaves the sketch of Freud's cranium as if it's a snail, as possibly the drawing he actually did here, which is contradicts completely what I've written in the panel outside here. So take no notice of that. But the point is, Dali had he tells a story in The Secret Life that he'd been having a gourmet dinner in a French town in Sens. It was Sens, somewhere like that. And he was eating snails, which is his favourite dish. And at the same time, his eye happened to catch a newspaper report of Freud arriving in Paris. And he saw the Freud's head, and he saw the snails, and he said, oh, that's it. Freud's cranium is a snail shell. That is, the shape is the spiral of a snail shell. In other words, it's like the golden section. It's the ideal shape. And the drawing there has that. Now, when that arrived, we looked at it and thought, he can't have done this in front of Freud. It doesn't even look like him. But he's written this little piece underneath saying, this drawing is done from life. So perhaps it was. I'm very interested to know what people think, because it's a little bit of a mystery. It could be that one. But I don't think they would want to show Freud a sketch of his head as a snail shell either. So I don't know. But it's a, yes.
There's a question there.
Thank you very much. That was most interesting. And I very much hesitate to ask for clarification, which will sound probably not informed enough and quite naive. When I look at Dali, he speaks the language of dream. If dream is the simplest, shortest way to the unconscious, is he not after something here? In analysis, we sit with a client and we deal with, well, we try to deal with unconscious content. Isn't Dali doing something similar with himself? As I've said, it probably sounds very naive, but I would very much welcome your clarification of that point.
Dali's, I mean, certainly, we'll talk about it more, but as far as actual dreams are concerned, certainly the surrealists were fascinated by the manifest content of dreams. Sometimes they analysed things, but on the whole they were interested in the actual, as it were, the material of the dream. Dali, for the book he wrote, The Tragic Myth of Miles Angelus, was obsessed with this painting, but he makes it very clear. He says at the beginning of the book, I absolutely never dreamt of the Angelus. So none of the paintings he did, could one assume, were to do with dream images. Now this is just one aspect of it. How far that was true anyway, who knows? That's what he claims.
Yeah, I think the mistake is to, you know, is to link Dali to dreams. People say Dali is the industrial light and magic of psychoanalysis, that Dali's paintings are the special effects department of psychoanalysis. And we did a conference a few years ago with artists who were talking about their dreams and how their dreams had shaped, influenced their own work, their own production. And when it was time for the panel at the end of the day, the guy there, the academic who studies things like this, made an intervention and said, well, you know, this is all very interesting, but actually dreams, you know, the best image we have of dreams are Dali's paintings. So totally ignoring the actual real images that had come from dreams. And I think, you know, some dreams might involve, you know, flying penises and soft watches, but most dreams aren't really like Dali's paintings at all, maybe hardly ever. What is interesting is this idea of what the dream produces in terms of incompatible, empirically impossible juxtapositions, things that can't happen, which for Freud is very, very precise, not in terms of interpreting the meaning of each of the objects, events, juxtapositions, but rather what they show about a structural process. And one thing, again, you could kind of contrast Dali's endless riffing around the Angelus with, you know, what does Freud say after the dream book in 1899 that Dali had read so carefully? If you look at almost every single publication that Freud makes in the next, you know, 35 years about dreams, they're all going in exactly the same direction. They're all saying, just don't try and interpret dreams. He says, give up your exaggerated respect for dreams. Don't see dreams as the fantastic world road to the unconscious. And he replaces the Deutung that had obviously been the key, you know, aperture onto the dream, the Traumdeutung, interpretation of dreams, with the idea of the Handlung, the handling of dreams. And, you know, by the 1920s, he's saying it's impossible to interpret a dream. What you have to do, give up the idea of a narrative. Again, contrast how Dali finds a narrative, a structure behind the Angelus. And rather, Freud's saying, just take one element and see where it goes. Just focus on, you know, the pitchfork or the wheelbarrow. Just follow that. Don't try and make sense. Don't try and make a story about the image. Don't try and find a story behind the dream. So you have a very radical difference between the early work, which one could argue was kind of misunderstood or misappropriated by many of Freud's readers and some of the surrealists, and what Freud is getting at in the later treatment of dreams.
There's a lot we can go on to say about that, but it was the cause of one of the biggest disputes between the surrealists and Freud, because they asked him to contribute a preface to a collection, an anthology of dreams and writing about dreams. And he refused, but he said he couldn't see what possible interest such a thing could have for anyone. So the idea of analysing, if you like, taking out a single element, mm-hmm. obviously was one that the surrealists did it. I mean, they did actually follow that a little bit and enjoyed
it.
But the idea that the dream could be a model for the visualisation of surrealism was rejected mm-hmm. at the very beginning. Some things were, you know, could be extracted from, but that wasn't the model for the visual.
But aren't there different models with different surrealists?
Different models. Every artist had their own their own idea. But it was Dali really who, as it were, in a devious way. And I think, you know, the paintings are not dreams.
Absolutely.
I won't go on about this.
I mean, in a way, we do a great disservice to dreams, and perhaps the Dali, if we take Dali's paintings as a model for the dream. Mm.
Okay. I'm actually studying photography, and I'm learning a lot from this, because I'm having to write a dissertation about Freud linking with the surrealists and... analysing a lot of surrealist work. As you've said a lot through your talk, that the surrealists admired a lot of Freud's theories, but I was wondering, what was it like the other way around? I think you said something a bit earlier, but wondering if Freud appreciated what the surrealists were doing with their work, because obviously Freud was a very serious man, and whereas the don't know if would you have taken them like for a little bit of a joke?
Well, there's a famous letter from Freud to Stefan Zweig, who, the day after, Zweig took Dali to see him, saying, "Thank you very much for bringing yesterday's visitors. I had always been inclined to view the surrealists, who seem to have adopted me as their patron saint, as 95% cranks like alcohol. But this young Spaniard is, you know, helping to revise my opinion." So he didn't have a high opinion of the surrealists. He didn't understand what they were doing. He wrote to André Breton after one of Breton's many attempts to sort of engage in dialogue, saying, "I don't understand what you're doing, and perhaps I am not fitted to do so, I who am so far from art." Because I think that you know, he was very conservative in his tastes in art. He obviously loved antiquities he has downstairs and so on, because of what they actually represented, I think, in terms of myths and earlier ideas about sexuality and so on. I think he didn't, you know, he didn't appreciate them. They went on trying to be appreciated by him and taken more seriously, but they weren't prepared to give up the idea that poetic experiment and artistic experiment and creation were actually worth doing in their own right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's easier for the people at the back to hear you if you use it. Yes.
First of all, do you think the spiritualist artists are closest to representing the subconscious as opposed to the surrealists? And also, do you think the writings of the poetry is meant to change your impersonation or your impression of that work? So it gives you two meanings. Mm-hmm. The visual side of it gives you one meaning when you look at it. You read the poem, it gives you a different meaning, mm-hmm. which is the kind of double image again.
Do you want to answering that was good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point I was making about spiritualism is that beyond the conscious deliberations of some of the surrealists, what you find in the end is a model of the unconscious as a kind of second hidden consciousness, which is, for me, closer to spiritualist discourse than it is to psychoanalysis, where the unconscious is more like an elision in speech than a different kind of consciousness. In terms of the double image, I mean, is it a question of getting one image through the poem and one image through the picture, or rather seeing a kind of attempt to push us towards thinking about how words are transformed into images? So it's not two different things.
I think they run parallel. I think they are two different things, actually. I mean, I think that there's obviously a huge amount of disagreement about the relationship between the word and the image in, you know, as it becomes conscious, even in a dream, when you wake up. And the idea... I'm afraid I'm reverting to the surrealist notion of the unconscious here, which I know is not really very very pertinent to psychoanalysis.
Which surrealists, though?
Well, I'm talking about Breton.
Breton,
yeah. And he thinks that really it's only in a sort of primitive, what he calls primitive unconscious, that you have the purely visual. Otherwise, it is always, as it were, it's been transferred into a word. Mm-hmm. But in terms of this, the poem and the painting, it's very difficult to say. I mean, I think one can go on looking at that painting, and it actually changes as you look at it. I mean, there's a great deal more to it, many, many layers to it, which are not in the poem. The poem is a kind of narrative. A narrative which seems to be more like actually burying the myth of Narcissus, which is not exactly what the painting does. I mean, the poem doesn't end with the death of Narcissus. It ends with, quite shockingly in a way, the Narcissus actually becoming Gala.
A birth.
Yeah. So in a way he is solving it from his point of view. He's saying this, you know, I'm not suffering from Narcissism, I've got Gala. The painting is much, I mean, it goes on being unresolved, it seems to me. That's what I would say there.
Hiya, sorry. On from the painting and the image, would there be a sense that, sorry, the poem and the image, not the painting and the image, would there be a sense that the poem, in a sense of, would be like another reflection of a double image, but across medium, in a sense that it's like ekphrasis, like a kind of another interpretation, a reinterpretation. And in that sense, it is another double image, but across the medium of painting to language. And then in that sense, it's like another reflection rather than a burying or a closure. Or would you not agree?
I mean, yes, it could be. I mean, it gives Dali an opportunity also to bring in some other of his particular obsessions, like the terrible excrement-eating hand. I mean, that's something you don't really see in the painting. So it allows him to elaborate in a way. Whether it actually could constitute anything like, a third image, I'm not sure. It's a very interesting thought.
One thing that occurred to me when you were talking, something rang very true to me when you were talking about dreams and the fact that what struck me is that dreams always feel like something that you're actually experiencing. The uncanny thing about dreams is that when you're having a dream, it's like reality, and actually describing Dali as the dream artist is kind of a misnomer. But what struck me was whether Dali had ever been, whether the term psychedelic is ever used with Dali's work visually, just because there's a kind of like unsubtle sort of quality to the imagery. It's sort of violently odd and vivid, and it's, from what I've read about psychedelic experience and the colours and all the rest of it, is this something that he was interested in at any point? Was this something that informed his work? Is it even a word that's used to describe his work? Or
yes, I'm just trying to. He didn't, so far as I know, ever experience the effect of psychedelic drugs in terms of, you know, the very kind of violent and very strong visual effects. But he was interested in the art that this sort of pop artists were producing. He certainly liked that. He wanted to be part of that. He always said he didn't need any additional stimulus to, to get to the point that some people did need drugs to help them.
Yeah.
Oh, hi. I just like to ask, Freud's theory on vivid anxiety, and I'd like to know a little bit more about how Dali used Freud's theory of anxiety, maybe perhaps in his own paintings and artwork.
I'm not aware of Dali commenting explicitly about that. I don't know.
I don't know, but could you explain what the theory of anxiety is? How one might take it on.
There are several different theories of anxiety in Freud. There's the first theory from the 1890s, which is the idea that anxiety is the result of repression. And then he changes his mind in the 1920s and says it's the other way around, that repression is the result of anxiety. And he moves towards a theory where, rather than seeing more of a kind of continuum between anxiety and sexuality, anxiety is a signal which prepares you for something that's going to happen, which is why having anxiety dreams is actually a positive rather than a negative thing. And he argues that, you know, some of the worst traumatic neuroses that had been described after the First War were not so much, you know, the result of people having, you know, a massive influx of anxiety, but the contrary, that they didn't have anxiety as a preparatory signal for the trauma. Yeah, so it changes from the 1890s to the 20s. But I don't know at all whether Dali is.
No, I mean, it's hard to. I mean, from the evidence of the paintings, he was very prepared to say, I'm extremely anxious, and this, and these are the, you know, these are the ways it's going to manifest itself. And
I just thought I'd ask, because they talk about, you said he Dali was stayed away from the war. I thought maybe he was paint about his anxieties, perhaps about those. Don't you know what I mean?
Oh, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, but he usually turns it into something else. So with the bomb, he was completely obsessed with the atomic bomb, and he decided he was going to embrace it, having been utterly terrified by it. So that was the way he tended to go, was to actually turn it into the opposite. Mm.
Thank you.
Should we do that?
Yes.
Embrace the bomb.
Hi, this is a question to Dawn. Does something happen to you personally in your life to make you interested or inspired in surrealism before you were interested?
I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of. No, I think not. Absolutely nothing like that at all. And I'm afraid it's a terribly basic, purely aesthetic interest in the relationship between words and images, I mean, which I have always been fascinated by. And surrealism seemed to be the one place in the 20th century where I was interested in 20th century art, but I found it too up itself, if you like, I didn't like modernism, really, and surrealism, where actually there is no visual style at all, and there's a very close relationship between the writers and the poets and the visual works, although it's of a quite, as you quite rightly say, they're in very varied kind, was what I was fascinated by. And I started working on something called Hans Arp, and the particular ways in which the kind of cadences of his poems relate to the way his sculptures operate, I was fascinated by. I was interested in quite formal ways of looking at the relationship between words and images. And then develop beyond that.
I'm afraid we have to finish with that question, but that was a really good question to end on. Thank you. And I'd also like to thank both of our speakers tonight, not only for speaking tonight, but also for their contributions, both of them, to the exhibition, for Don's curatorial work and for Darian's general support and support for CIFAR and the College of Sacramento. So please join me in giving them a round of applause.